for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio. Whoops, I need to turn on the damn thing, don't I? Oh, yeah. For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Thanks for listening. Websites real quick, antiwar.com, best place to go to find all the bad news in the whole wide world every day, and the best commentary. And you know what? I'm not taking credit for it. I'm just one of the handful of guys that works there. But collectively, whatever, all the credit to them. We're ahead of the curve on every single thing. And there's no conflict on Earth, particularly regarding American foreign policy, that you did not read first at antiwar.com. Whether it's the coup d'etat proxy war in Somalia, whether it's coverage of the march toward the Iran war, Justin Raimondo's unmatched history of the neoconservative movement and their long march from Trotskyism to being Dick Cheney's cabal for Israel and Lockheed and assorted warmongering interests. There is no better place to go than antiwar.com. So look at that. My blog is thestressblog.com. Stop by. Give a shout in the comments section if you want. And all the interview archives are at scotthortonshow.com. Now, unfortunately, I was going to talk with this lady, Ann Mullen, I thought, from the Detroit Metro Times, all about the Detroit case, which I'm prepared for, but she flaked out, which I was not prepared for, so I'm just going to wing it. There's two big countries in the Middle East that start with IR and A, and, you know, I'm pretty sure I can figure out an hour worth of news stories to help cover for you here on Anti-War Radio today. Second hour, we'll be talking with Nelson Linder, the head of the local Austin, Texas chapter of the NAACP, a friend of mine. I look forward to interviewing very much. Anti-War Radio. A million pilgrims told to leave Karbala. A million Shiites ordered out of holy city of Karbala after pilgrimage violence kills 35. You know, last night I told my friend, a million people forced out of Kabbalah. Giant Shiite pilgrimage thing. Badr versus Sadr. They started shooting at each other. And the government or whoever ordered a million people to flee. And he said, huh? And I said, a million people were forced to flee from Kabbalah today. And he went, wait, what? And I said, man, today in Iraq, during a massive Shiite pilgrimage to Karbala, gunfire broke out between the Sadr and the Badr, and a million people were forced to flee. And he said, oh my God. Yeah, that's, I don't know. It's kind of hard to imagine. I can understand why his brain was, you know, taking that information and spitting it back out. It couldn't be right. What do you mean, a million internal refugees created in a day? What do you mean, Scott Horton? That's like, you know, that's the kind of things that make it into holy books. That time a million people had to flee from the big battle. How could that be? I saw that headline in the LA Times and I thought, nah, this is wrong, dude. Show me some other media. I went to Google News and started Googling around Karbala. Oh, yeah. The LA Times had it right. Vada versus Sauter, as they compete over who's going to control what's left of what the United States government has destroyed there. And I swear to God, if I hear one more time that we have to stay until things are better, I'm going to, I can't say puke blood because that's a Bill Hicks thing. I don't want to just directly rip off Bill Hicks. I don't know what I'm going to do. Stab myself in the ear with an ice pick. I'm going to go absolutely insane if I hear one more person tell me, oh, well, see how bad it is? We can't leave now. I mean, are you people smoking crack? Justin Raimondo, in his column that's running today on antiwar.com, has it exactly right. You pro-war dead-enders, you're the crackpots. I mean, here I am. I'm an anarcho-capitalist. I'm libertarianism at its absolute extreme. And I'm the calm and reasonable and rational one. And you people are freaking cuckoo, man. I mean, the talking points are wearing pretty thin at this point. If we leave now, the soldiers will have died in vain. What you mean is, you supported a war that got a bunch of Americans killed for nothing. That's what you mean to say. That they already have died in vain. Now you're trying to find an excuse for what your support helped do to them. And yeah, adding more piles of Americans dead for nothing is not going to fix that. George Bush, there's a great article on antiwar.com today. The Waning Power of the War Myth by Gary Kamiya. In fact, I think I'll share a little bit of this with you, actually. I'm just winging it. By the way, see what a horrible and lousy, non-talent-having radio host I am? I didn't even give out the phone number. It's 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. I could have got a 1-800 number, but it would have cost a lot of money, and long distance is pretty much free nowadays anyway, right? 512-646-6446, if any of y'all want to jump in here. What happened? I hit the wrong link. Bush's entire presidency has been propped up by the war myth by aggressively presenting himself as a war leader, by wrapping himself in the sacred robes of patriotism, the military, and national honor. Bush has taken refuge in the Holy of Holies, the ultimate sanctuary in American life. He has made criticism of his policies tantamount to criticism of the one institution in American life that is untouchable, the military. The military is untouchable? Who wrote this? Wait. He uses the almost 4,000 new crosses in military cemeteries as a talisman against his opponents, notwithstanding the fact he is wholly responsible for those crosses. War may, as Randolph Bourne argued, be the health of the state, but it is definitely the health of the presidency. Paradoxically, the very thing that has destroyed Bush's presidency, his disastrous war in Iraq, is also the only thing propping it up. War is an incompetent leader's Waterloo, but also his best friend. Being a war president, as Bush incessantly calls himself, means never having to say you're sorry. No matter how many lives you have destroyed, you're not to blame. And it goes on like that. And, you know, I heard somebody, I think this was on TV or something the last few weeks, or maybe I read it somewhere. See, when I turned 18, Bill Clinton was sending peacekeepers all over the world, and I sure as hell wasn't joining up for any of that craziness. So, I don't know. But I guess and obviously I'm not stupid. I know there's like a division here. But the way I heard it put the other day, I guess, made it more clear to me that to the soldiers, they consider themselves not the government, but government employee, or not even government employees. They're the people. Their officers are the government. The officers are the government. The regular enlisted guys are the people under the control of the government over there doing their soldierly duty, etc. Now, to me, they're all government employees running around with guns under government authority, and I don't necessarily make that distinction. But I can see how on the inside, there is definitely a distinction there. And it's clear that when Bush is wrapping himself in the military, he's not wrapping himself in the officer corps. He's wrapping himself in the 18-year-old kids that he's fooled their parents into giving them over fresh out of high school, who think of themselves as the people, not as the government themselves, but the people over there fighting this war, loyally doing their duty, defending their country, and so forth. And, you know, it's funny. I'm really surprised that this is still going on the way it is. I mean, the excuses that they've got, I mean, Bush saying, look, I've got us into a Vietnam War for no good reason, based on at least, you know, from his mouth, things that turned out to not be right, the so-called threat of Saddam Hussein, got us into what he is now calling a Vietnam War, even though, of course, he's denounced any comparison like that all along, and so is the entire war party. Now he's comparing it to Vietnam, saying that if America had stayed in Vietnam, then the massacres in Cambodia would have never happened. Well, that's funny. You know, Gareth Porter, who's a historian primarily on that period in American history, he wrote a thing making explicitly clear that the short-term alliance between the Khmer Rouge and the Viet Cong was simply and factually and unequivocally a result of Richard Nixon's policy that we can't leave now or things will be worse. And instead of leaving now because things will be worse, that is the make-believe South Vietnamese government, quote-unquote, would fall, because of that policy, and another 4 years in Vietnam after that, only then was the situation created where the Khmer Rouge was powerful enough to march on Phnom Penh, and in fact, America supported the Khmer Rouge in those efforts, at least at first. And then it was the North Vietnamese communists who went in there and put an end to it. While at the same time, as you know, the Chomskyites out there will point out, at the same time, or, you know, a year later, what have you, they told Sukarno in Indonesia to go ahead and kill them all in East Timor. Just as many dead there. Oh, but they're right-wing fascist mass murderous death squad butchers, and so that's okay. Rather than being Pol Pot, who was, you know, initially had the support of America anyway. So, I mean, the fact that that even needs to be addressed, the fact that the American people still don't even have enough just simple background knowledge of Vietnam, that are we really willing as a population, like overall, to accept that talking point from this White House, that the problem with the Vietnam War was that it ever ended, that we could have won if only we'd stayed? And what was to win? It's not like we're talking about fighting off a North Vietnamese invasion and then, you know, bombing their capital in retaliation. We're talking about winning a colonial war of occupation. You know, John Kennedy had the government he was in there fighting shot in the head and replaced. And then I think there were two or three more coups after that in South Vietnam. It was all just ridiculous puppet Maliki government crap. There was no South Vietnam. It wasn't a war between communism and capitalism. It was a war between the people who were from there and the colonial occupiers, period. Don't give me this crap about could have won, would have prevented more violence by causing more violence. You want to cite the massacres in Cambodia to me? The United States of America killed 3 million Vietnamese in that war. 3 million. And you're telling me if we'd stayed and killed millions more, it would have prevented some hundreds of thousands from dying? I mean, this is ridiculous. This is absolutely crazy. It's like my friend Phil in the comment section at Stress is always invoking the Three Stooges, you know? Like, that's exactly what this is. It's Three Stooges foreign policy and Three Stooges propaganda. I mean, you're talking about the people who are writing these talking points are an inch deep. They have no idea what they're even talking about. And the fact that this is working on anyone, that they're invoking Vietnam to say that's why we have to stay? Oh, man. You know, when I was a kid, the first time I ever learned anything about Vietnam, really, I think, I was at my friend's house down the street, and his parents were very conservative, Republican-type people. And my friend mentioned Vietnam. I was probably in third or fourth grade or something. And my friend mentioned Vietnam and his mom. Well, this is, you know, early 80s. So it had been a few years, but not that many years, you know. It ended basically right before I was born. So this is like, I guess, mid 80s or something, 10 years later or something. And she said, there's a civil war on the other side of the planet and it was none of our goddamn business. We had no reason to be over there, and all our guys died for nothing, and it was wrong. And I went, whoa, you know what? That might be the most conviction I've ever heard anything said with in my 10 short years of life so far. And she seemed to know of what she spoke, and yeah, she was right. And hey, here's the funny part. Ho Chi Minh was trying to suck up to the United States. Ha ha. Ho Chi Minh made a Declaration of Independence that he plagiarized from Thomas Jefferson. Did you know that? That he had said, hey America, you know, the French, they gotta leave one way or another. How about you help us encourage the French to leave and we'll be friends? And America's, the Eisenhower administration, I believe it was, could have been Kennedy. I think it was Eisenhower's guys, said, absolutely not. Screw you, Ho Chi Minh. Go see if you can get the Russians to back you. Maybe they will. We've got to have an excuse, you know. What are we going to do? We can't just be imperialists. We have to contain communism in Southeast Asia, see? And see, and here's the other funny thing, too, is as Gareth Porter pointed out, America won, basically. This is what Ron Paul says, too. Look at what happened. America left Vietnam. Nixon went to China, shook hands with Mao. Mao turns around and dies. Deng Xiaoping comes to power. Bam. China's capitalist. Well, fascist. And the dominoes didn't fall. And communism didn't dominate Asia and the world. And by the way, America won the Cold War. And the Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore. But no, we're still fighting the Vietnam War. I don't know. I'm sorry. So this guy, Gary Kamiya in Salon.com, the spotlight article on antiwar.com today, he's saying, as Iraq dies, Bush is falling back on his old standby, patriotic blackmail, but this time it won't work. And I'm not certain that that's true. Why shouldn't it work? It works every time. It has worked every time up till now. But again, I guess it's not that I'm surprised, but I am still a bit shocked that it works. How could it still work? I mean, I'm sure you guys saw all about the, well, Raimondo on antiwar.com called it the home front surge. The advertising campaign put on by Ari Fleischer and the Israel lobby. I mean, that was the Washington Post. It was like, hey, by the way, here's who's bankrolling this. And it was all, you know, zillionaires connected to the Israel lobby very closely. And that doesn't just mean, oh, they're Jewish, huh? No, that means they're closely connected to the Israel lobby, the individuals. I know how people... I see, I'm not going to do that anymore. like preemptively defending myself from people putting words in my mouth. You don't like it. I'm getting better at not cussing, too. You know I was going to finish that sentence. Yeah, the War Party's ad campaign. Oh, boo-hoo, I lost my legs over there, so we have to finish the job. And then they brought Ari Fleischer on Hardball and asked him, hey, man, it wasn't Chris Matthews, it was Zola, what's his name, filling in for him. And they asked him, oh, yeah, Ari Fleischer, what's the name of the soldier in your commercial? And Ari Fleischer said, I don't know. Gee, I don't have it right here in front of me. Yeah, he cares so much about honoring this soldier. We have to keep the war going to honor this kid who lost his legs for nothing. We have to make sure more kids lose their legs just to justify this kid losing his for nothing, see? Oh, his name? I don't fucking know. Quote Ari Fleischer. What do I care? He said, you know, real quietly under his breath. And then they have this lady who says, yeah, my uncle died in 9/11. My husband died in Iraq. They attacked us. We can't quit now. They, huh? Well, that's a little vague. If let's try to define that a couple of different ways. If she's talking about the war in Iraq, and we're to substitute Iraq, the nation state of Iraq, the government of Iraq, the Saddam Hussein bought this dictatorship in Iraq, if that's who she's saying attacked us, well, she's either an idiot or a liar, because that's just not true. And if she's saying they attacked us, referring to actual people who did attack us, then she would be referring to Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who were seemingly, to my eyes at least, allowed deliberately to escape from Tora Bora, and who are now holed up safe in the allied puppet dictatorship state of Pakistan. So how does that justify continuing a war in Iraq again? It doesn't. How does Vietnam justify keeping us in a war over there? It doesn't. Are there any more excuses? I mean, it ought to be, it seems to me, that if the pro-war people are saying, yeah, you know, victory's around the corner, and we're making progress, and you just want to stab the soldiers in the back, and etc. like that. If that's all they got, and the anti-war people are saying things like, look, here are the different factions, here's what they're fighting about, here's which foreign countries on the outside, including the U.S., are backing which factions toward what end, here's the tactics, here's the strategy, here's what they're doing, you tell me if it's progress. And that argument loses to boo-hoo, my uncle was a firefighter on 9/11? My uncle was a firefighter on 9/11. Keep the war going. That's all they got now. That's the best that the Israel lobby with all their millions can produce for TV. My uncle died on 9/11. Vote Republican. And that's all they got. That's all they got. But let's just keep it going anyway. And let's not notice the fact that it's the Israel lobby that's behind this. This latest propaganda push and the majority of this policy anyway. I mean, here's these, what, four or five different TV commercials that they've made here. All full of, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, Midwestern, Southern, regular old folk kind of folk. And yet there's a foreign lobby that's bankrolling the whole thing. Americans, but who are extremely closely tied to the establishment in Israel. The American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee and the various Israel lobby think tanks here in the U.S. That's who's putting this on. You think if you really ask the average soldier at the recruiting station, all right, son, now when you sign here, it means that you're going to die for Israel. Would they all still sign up? Doesn't it seem funny that there are no just regular, plain old, pro-American, right-wing nationalist groups who are pushing this? Instead, they're being pushed, and in some cases dragged, toward this war? And no, I'm not going to preemptively, put up a disclaimer for, trying to put words in my mouth. I don't care what you say. The Israel lobby are the ones pushing this surge crap. Them and their neocon buddies. And they're the ones who are pushing us toward war with Iran. And I don't know, I guess, are they running these commercials during the sporting events and stuff? Is this running during the baseball and football games? Hi, I'm Ari Fleischer from the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, here to tell you why you ought to send your son to the Marine Corps to die for Israel. Go home team. Oh well, there's nothing wrong with that, right? Americans dying in wars waged on behalf of other countries, that's the way it's supposed to be, isn't it? That's just like George Washington recommended. He said, from now on, the leaders of this country have a responsibility to loot the people who live here of every cent we possibly can without them overthrowing it us, and then spend as much of it as possible killing foreigners for their own good. It's right there in the farewell address. And who knows what's even going on in Kurdistan? I don't even have a good source for what's going on in Kurdistan. I don't even know what's a good paper to read to keep up with what's going on in Kurdistan. I read something that the Iranians had moved in and had done strikes a few miles into Iraq. What? Now, if that's true, I can't verify it for you now, but let's run with that just for the moment. Iran actually invades Iraq? And the American media doesn't jump all over it? The war party doesn't jump all over it and put this out everywhere? Well, why would that? How could that possibly be? Because they're fighting against the Kurds? Fighting against those most determined to achieve Kurdish independence? And the stab in the back is coming. And I guess my money is on the Kurds getting the knife rather than the Turks. But there's a big fight coming over who controls Kurdistan. And, if you're picturing a little territory that ends with a line at the northern border of Iraq, well, that would be true in terms of political maps, but in reality, the Kurdish people, their ethnicity and so forth, tribal, what have you, all goes up into vast parts of Turkey. I guess less so now because Bill Clinton gave them bazillions of dollars worth of Lockheed and assorted military equipment in the 1990s to slaughter the Kurds with. At the same time, of course, America was backing them in northern Iraq. But the Turks are not about to stand idly by and let an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq join up with the Kurds in Turkey. They'd lose a third of their country, maybe more than that. I don't know. Maybe a quarter. But the Turks aren't going to let that happen. They've been America's loyal NATO ally for 50 years, so I'm not sure whether that means they're the more likely candidate to be stabbed in the back, or whether the Kurds, who've been our loyal allies for, 15 years, 16 years, whether they're the ones more likely to get it. But this is the situation created by the Iraq invasion. And it's not over yet in Kurdistan. I don't even have a good source. I know Mitskin's got a blog, and I don't even know who Mitskin is, but there's someone named Mitskin who has a blog that I believe is, like, very, I barely ever even read it, just a few times, actually. I guess I should go look at it more. But it's, I believe, very pro-Kurdish nationalism type thing. Pro-PKK. But I don't even know. I guess I need to go spend an afternoon Googling and try to find out what's going on in Kurdistan. That's I think that has incredible long-term potential for vast conflict. Vast conflict. As far as I know, the Kurds have never had their own land, you know, autonomous. It's always been one empire or another. Of course, Wilson promised them a Kurdistan after World War I and then turned them over to the British. But, yeah, there's a big conflict to brew in there. And, of course, there's Kurdish populations in Syria and, as I was indicating, Iran. I wonder if that's right. Does anybody know if that's right? That the Iranians actually invaded Iraq last week or 2 weeks ago, but they did so in order to fight the Kurds, who are ostensibly our friends, and that's why the Americans kept it quiet? Some indication of that, anyway. That's the rumor, as far as I know. But, yeah, what time is it? It's 11:30. You know what I ought to do? Play a song. Why not, right? You guys like songs, don't you? This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott. Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott. That's MDC. Jim Loeb, the great Jim Loeb. What would we do without Jim Loeb? Oh, by the way, it's 512-646-6446. Not like any of you guys, you know, are, I don't know what, thin, strong enough, have the energy to pick up a goddamn telephone and hit some buttons. Probably kill you, right? Jim Loeb is best known for his coverage of U.S. foreign policy, particularly the neoconservative influence in the Bush administration. A blog entry by him at the Loeb blog, linked today in the viewpoint section of antiwar.com. The American Enterprise Institute to roll out the Iranian time bomb September 10th. Just 4 days after the American Enterprise Institute will launch its September 6th all-or-nothing campaign to save the surge, it will debut freedom scholar Michael Ledeen's forthcoming book, The Iranian Time Bomb, The Mullah Zealot's Quest for Destruction, a rehash of neocon arguments for regime change by military force if necessary in Tehran. Judging by the excerpts that have been released to date, Ledeen's latest tract will be entirely predictable, although in addition to emphasizing, as he has for much of the last several years, the urgent need to support and fund the regime's domestic opposition, he concludes that, quote, this presidential administration or the next will likely face a terrible choice, appease a nuclear Iran or bomb it before their atomic weapons are ready to go, while a sad exclamation point at the end of nearly 30 years of failed policy, confrontation may be virtually inescapable. Like other ideological wars of the 20th century, this war will likely only end when one side has lost. Joining Ledeen in the afternoon panel will be former CIA Director James Woolsey, which, here's, I'm going to say something nice about Bill Clinton. I know you, I'm going to say one thing nice about Bill Clinton. And I only read this one place and I don't even remember where, so it may not even be true. But I heard that Bill Clinton met with James Woolsey once and then instructed his aides, I don't ever want to see that kook in my presence again. Keep him the hell away from me and keep as much authority out of the hands of the CIA as you can while that guy's running it. Jesus. That's a compliment, Bill. You face-biting rapist, Waco-burning traitor, murderer. That part wasn't very complimentary, I guess. Joining Ledeen in the afternoon panel will be former CIA Director James Woolsey, the longtime Iran hawk who still believes Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda were tight and no doubt agrees with Ledeen's analysis that Iran and al-Qaeda have been even tighter. And this is most interesting, retired General Jack Keane, one of the architects along with Fred Kagan and other AEI scholars of the surge. Perhaps Keane is brought in order to echo the recent crescendo of charges regarding Iran's alleged supply of explosively formed projectiles to Shiite militias. But I'll be interested to see whether he promotes the increasingly fashionable idea among hawks in and outside of the government in favor of cross-border raids into Iran, something that the Pentagon, I am told, is definitely against. Keane, of course, is regarded as close to General David Petraeus, and whatever he says on the subject of Iran should be listened to closely for evidence if a widening split between the Joint Chiefs on one hand and Petraeus, the neocon Caesar, on the other. Jim Loeb continues. The chronological juxtaposition of the surge panel September 6th and the rollout of Ledeen's book September 10th underlines the balance that AEI and other hawks, including the Vice President's office, are trying to achieve between their two top priorities at the moment. Sustaining the surge well into next year and rallying Congress and the public behind an attack on Iran before the end of Bush's term. If by then diplomacy does not achieve the desired results of, one, freezing its nuclear program, and or, two, halting Tehran's support for its Shiite militias, including the Maliki government in Iraq. To their dismay, they have been forced to spend far more time, effort, and above all, ink on defending the surge over the past 8 months than on laying the groundwork for an attack on Iran, although they are showing signs in recent days of trying hard to make up the difference. If it becomes clear by late September or early October that Democrats and uneasy Republicans will indeed acquiesce in the continuation of the surge, at least until next spring, when troop numbers will almost certainly have to be reduced anyway, I think it's very likely we will see a much bigger focus by AEI and the neocons, as well as their allies within the administration, on Iran and the necessity of a military confrontation before Bush leaves. Meanwhile, it's worth noting that AEI continues to go great guns on the Iran divestment front, although its Vice President of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies, Daniel Pletka, has an interesting op-ed in the subject in Tuesday's Washington Post, while the column help explains her somewhat surprising comment to the Financial Times earlier this month about the possible serious repercussions of our multilateral effort if Congress added sanctions to the Iran Sanctions Act. It also appeared to contain a number of contradictions. While on one hand, Pletka suggests that additional ISA sanctions risk alienating the European Union just when it is doing more to withdraw support from the Iranian economy, she lauds pending measures both in Congress and a growing number of state legislatures that would either encourage or compel pension funds and other institutional investors to divest their holdings in companies that do business with Iran. why Europeans would be offended by ISA's expansions and not similarly offended by the divestment movement, she fails to explain. The EU has been actively lobbying on Capitol Hill against the divestment-related legislation for at least 2 months. Her failure to address this distinction between the ISA and the divestment legislation is particularly notable in light of another column published by the Washington Times and National Review this week by her AEI colleague Michael Barone. His op-ed, Divest Iran, points that the firms that do the most business in Iran, and hence will presumably be hit hardest by a successful divestment campaign, are European, as well as Asian and Russian. I just don't understand the logic underlying Pletka's column. Perhaps someone can explain it to me, Jim Loeb writes. Yeah, I'm not really looking for reason and consistency from Daniel Pletka, Jim. Honestly, brother. I appreciate you, specifying what the contradiction is, but trying to, explain it with reason or something, that's probably not going to be right. Other than, it's reasonable to say that Daniel Pletka is just a liar and wants a war and is willing to say anything. Except, I guess, when put in specific check by somebody. That's happened a couple of weeks ago. But, let there be no doubt where War Party Central is. It's AEI headquarters. The American Enterprise Institute. I wonder if they were going to call it the Empire Institute, and then somebody said, no, that's probably going too far for public relations purposes, or exactly what happened there. The American Enterprise Institute. And just to think, the surge policy was cooked up at AEI? What the hell does that mean? I thought George Bush was a commander guy, doing what the commander said. But it was Fred Kagan who wrote this thing? Which, of course, we all knew that, right? In fact, I had a great time watching Fred Kagan in a blog war with Edward Djerian from the James Baker Institute. There's your neocon old establishment split for you right there. That's an interesting read. Quite venomous. I like that. When, competing members of the war party go at each other. Can be enlightening. So I guess the big question really is for Iraq is whether Alawi's next, whether they're going to, completely stab al-Maliki in the back and replace him with Iyad Alawi, the former interim prime minister, CIA agent, former Baathist truck bomber, torturer, murderer, who became a CIA agent, truck bomber, murderer. There's a lot of money floating around D.C. looking for Iyad Alawi. And it was funny, in yesterday's interview with the other Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine, the international human rights lawyer, he talked about kind of hearing through the grapevine, hey, Alawi's in town and there's a bunch of Republican money behind him. And he went, nah, come on. What do you mean, Alawi? Nah. And then there it was, a few days later, all of a sudden there he is writing in the Times or the Post. I forgot which it was now. Talking about how he ought to be the new dictator of Iraq again. And, as Romano pointed out on the anti-war blog, I think he called it Maliki's new street cred. The more George Bush and for that matter, Hillary Clinton and the rest of them talk bad about Maliki and about how it's time for him to go, the better he looks in Iraq. They told him, you better, stay away from Iran and Syria. Follow my commands. So he said, oh yeah? And he went to Iran and Syria. It's probably the best thing he could have done. If they try to kill him, he might actually have some real credibility. But yesterday, things took a real ominous turn in the war toward Iran when Ahmadinejad said, ah, the American empire is, weak and is a coward, and George Bush is a mama's boy, and they're going to leave soon, and there will be a giant power vacuum in Iraq, and we are ready to fill it, he said. No thanks to George Bush spending the last 5 years training and arming and financing Ahmadinejad's guys from the Hakim clan, the Badr Corps, and the Supreme Islamic Council. Oh, no thanks to George Bush. Please, remember that history starts yesterday. And that as far as you know, America has never done anything to empower the pro-Iran factions in Iraq. History started yesterday. Okay? So now, somehow, for some reason, through no fault of the United States of America, Iran is in a position of vast influence in Iraq. And so Ahmadinejad, with his big mouth, comes out yesterday to taunt George Bush. Ha ha, George Bush, you're a failure. You've handed the south of Iraq over to me. You'll be lucky if I don't take all the rest of it by force, but that's up to me to decide, not you. And how do you like that, punk bitch? That's what he said to George Bush. And George Bush came out and said, oh yeah? And he leveled the same accusations that he's been leveling. Yeah, 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 one day their nuclear program might be able to make a bomb. Please. And their guys are killing our guys in Iraq. Even though still there's nothing saying that the Iranians are arming and supplying and training the Mahdi army. No evidence. Don't get me wrong. There are vast numbers of assertions that that is the case. But for the most part, you'll notice, and you have noticed, I'm sure, that whenever they accuse the Iranians of arming America's enemies in Iraq, they always vaguely say, well, radical Shiite militias. If they come right out and blame it all on Muqtada al-Sadr, I don't know if anybody would contradict him, but that would certainly not make any sense at all, since he's the nationalist and the one least tied to Iran. We've all known, if you listen to this show, you've known all along. If you read antiwar.com, you've known since before the war that the Badr Corps and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution were the only ones prepared to fill the power vacuum, that is Iran. They were the only ones prepared to fill the power vacuum when America invaded. And they're the ones who the Iranians are backing and arming and training, and they're our guys. Well, up until, this week, last week, they've been our guys. Iran has been arming America's friends in Iraq, not America's enemies in Iraq. And now I'm already noticing in the paper, they're already saying the Shiite insurgency. The Shiite insurgency just rolls right off the tongue. Even though this whole time it's never been called the Shiite insurgency, right? Why? Because it ain't the Shiites. The insurgency is the Sunnis. But now they're the Sunni militias, our friends, fighting Al-Qaeda. And now the insurgency is the Shia insurgency. And they imply, but never outright say, because it would be, I guess, too easy to outright contradict them, but they imply that it's all Muqtada al-Sadr, that he's the guy who works for Iran, when in fact it's the Badr Corps that works for Iran. The guys that are the Iraqi army that George Bush has installed, quote-unquote, in power in Iraq. The Badr Corps that started fighting with the Mahdi army in Karbala yesterday, leading to 1 million people fleeing. Can't we all just get along? They used to be the Iraqi National the United Iraqi Alliance together. And why didn't that work out? Why? Because Sadr is a nationalist. He doesn't want to give the south of Iraq, and for that matter the rest of the country, to Iran. He wants to be the dictator of Iraq, and he wants it to stay Iraq. And he's willing to work with the Sunnis to do that. That's why he's broken off. That's why Badr and Sadr are fighting. Because the Supreme Council, the guys who control the Badr Corps, they want to basically just take the south of Iraq and hand it to Iran. Make it a little independent Shiistan in the south, in alliance with Iran. Oh, no, but, yeah, stabbed the troops in the back and Vietnam and, loved the soldiers and, died in vain and, what is it, GOPtalkingpoints.com, or I can get some more of this crap. Because anybody who can make the slightest bit of sense out of the situation in Iran and Iraq, as I've just kind of so-called stumbled through laying it out in the last hour, would see that the only thing now is for America to leave. To leave. What are we going to do about the Kurds and the Turks? What are we going to do about the Sunnis, who we've overthrown from power and are, for intents and purposes, keeping from being obliterated by the Iran factions? You know, overthrow Maliki, replace him with Alawi. Gonna back the Iranians and then call Sadr an Iranian and battle him. Whole thing is a complete disaster. A total mess. And as Ron Paul has said it far more eloquently than I can, if things get worse after we leave, don't go blaming the anti-war people. It's the people who got us into this war who are responsible for that. Not the people who say it's got to end. The fact of the matter is, what we're doing there is not progress. It's not. There is no progress about it at all. You know, even the so-called progress in Anbar province, well, the Sunni militias have turned against Al-Qaeda. Well, that's not anything America did. That's because, as Patrick Coburn explained in his great article, the special report, The Surge, a special report by Patrick Coburn in The Independent, who will be joining us on the show tomorrow, as he explained, Al-Qaeda tried to set up an umbrella group for all of the Sunni insurgency. The foreign fighter religious jihadist crazies from Saudi Arabia and Egypt and whatever who came to Iraq to fight. They claim to, we are the Islamic State of Iraq and we're running this whole show now. And the local Iraqi said, all right, that's enough of this. And it was the local Sunnis who decided that their alliance with Al-Qaeda against us was no longer worthwhile and turned on them. That's not any, you know, particular heroic feat on the part of America. At all. America, the only thing America did to help make that the case is provide targets for Al-Qaeda to kill over these last few years to the point that they got strong enough that they had the balls enough to try to call themselves the Islamic State of Iraq and take over the whole insurgency. So I guess if you want to take credit for that, Republicans, you can. Congratulations. But then, so what do? They have to take credit, so they send in General Petraeus to say, oh yeah, this was my idea, getting the Sunni militia locals to turn on the Al-Qaeda fighters. I'm the one who came up with this. Here, guys, have a bunch of M16s and AK-47s and bombs and million-billion-dollar bills. That's progress. Look, the Sunnis are fighting Al-Qaeda. We're the ones who made it happen. One way or another. The long way or directly, whichever you prefer. And now what are we doing? We're arming the Sunni insurgency that's killed 3,700 American soldiers. We're arming the Sunni insurgency, the terrorists and the dead-enders, the bad, bad guys, the Sunnis who didn't want to give up everything after the war. The Ba'athists and the local Sunni religious and tribal leaders and so forth. We're arming and financing them, but to what end? That they're going to make an alliance with Maliki? That they're going to submit to the Dawa Party's Supreme Islamic Council government? Or even to Alawi? Is that what Alawi's going to do? We're going to overthrow Maliki and install Alawi, who got 0.2% of the vote in the election in January of 2005? We're going to install him, and then what? He's going to be the one who can make an alliance between the Supreme Islamic Council, the Sadrists, and the local Sunni leadership? And the Kurds, and then everything will be fine, and then we can leave? Is that what anybody thinks? Is there anybody who thinks that? Okay, well, great. Then, other than the fact that I'm being heard by literally dozens of people right now, I just won the argument, and the war's got to end tomorrow, right? There's nothing else you can say to that, right? Other than, oh, honor the guys who died for nothing by making more guys die for nothing. That's all you got, right? Okay, so I win the argument, and the war has to end immediately. Deal? Right? I don't see the phone ringing. Okay, nobody has any argument that can defeat my arguments for why America ought to leave. All the pro-war people are wrong and I'm right, and the war has to end right now. That's simple enough. And in case you're tuning in late and you're saying, yeah, but what about Cambodia? It was staying that caused Cambodia, stupid. I'm not going over the whole thing for you again. Why don't you try reading? Sorry, I kind of got a chip on my shoulder this morning, man. I wake up and I have in my email, oh, sorry, I decided I'm busy and I'm not going to show up and do your fucking show today. I realized I'd made plans to be an interviewee on your show, but I decided to do something else instead. And then I just spent an hour, really what really did it was spending an hour going through, best I can tell, right, closest approximation from Austin of what's going on in Iraq compared to the thinnest, shallowest, most base, meaningless talking point bullshit arguments of the war party. And I still lose. An hour straight of me being right and them being wrong, and I still lose. And George Bush comes out yesterday, all the same accusations, but much harsher. What's the quote? The quote is, I will take all actions necessary to protect our troops. I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities. In the same statement, Iran's pursuit of technology could lead to nuclear weapons. It could lead to a program that then could lead to nuclear weapons, I guess is what he meant to say. That's George Bush shorthand. Facts aren't all that important. The amount of evidence, here's the amount of evidence that the Iranian government is killing American soldiers in Iraq. You ready for it? Here it is. That's it. Nothing. That's all I got. Just a bunch of lies. Just blind accusations. Doesn't even make any sense. Everybody knows that the Iranians are helping the same guys as us. At least up until last week, whatever. Pure lies, but anyway, it's good enough to have a war. And this, the drumbeat, the echo chamber, it's working basically just as well as it did in the run-up to the war in Iraq. It's not quite as loud as it was before, but it's the same thing. It's the same three or four sources of lies being quoted around and around and around and around on all the war blogs and all the Fox News shows and, hell, all the MSNBC shows for that matter. Oh, what? Well, geez, I've heard 10 different times that it's Iran's fault our guys are dying in Iraq and, geez, I can't think of any background knowledge I might have to compare that to that would raise, you know, whether, you know, the question of whether that's really true or not. So, okay. Let's start all the rest of our arguments from now on by accepting the premise at the beginning that, yeah, Iran is bombing our guys in Iraq. Everybody knows that. And then let's have our argument from there. And you see how quickly the argument turns to, well, what are we waiting for? What are we going to do? America. Superman. Rocky Balboa. What are we going to do? Just sit there and let them kill our guys and do nothing about it? And it's on. I don't know how long it's going to be. Might be 6 months. I wouldn't be surprised if it was today. In fact, I really ought to have the TV on CNN on mute over here in the background to check over my shoulder. And, yeah, well, were any of you betting against Dick Cheney? I wasn't betting against Dick Cheney. And you know what? You know, for future reference and so forth, I wouldn't advise betting against Dick Cheney. You lose your money that way. I actually really wish I had placed a bet now, you know?
20,000 police in the whole town. Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Tonight that we got the truck, we're going downtown, gonna beat up drunks. Y'all turn the drive, I'll bring the beer. It's a late, late ship, no one to fear. And ride, ride, I'll ride. And ride, you ride. It's a round up time with a good horse. We're gonna drive one screaming off the street. And ride, ride, I'll ride. Uniform and a silver badge. Play cops for real, I play cops for pay. Let's ride, you dress is a kick in the ass. Let's beat your balloon till you shit in your pants. No moon child, got a big black stick. There's six of us, babe, so suck on my dick. And ride, ride, I'll ride. Let's ride, you ride. The left newspapers by who I'm a bit. But the guys at the station, they don't give a shit. Dispatch calls, oh, you're doing something wicked. No siree check, just shit and tickets. Let's ride, ride, I'll ride. And ride, ride, I'll ride. And ride, ride, I'll ride. Let's ride, you ride.
Hi, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. It's Chaos 95.9 Austin. Check this out, man. Vineyard Saker, whose blog is vineyardsaker.blogspot.com, and he's an extremely educated individual and provides a lot of really great analysis. You ought to check it out. He also is a co-blogger of mine over at stressblog.com. And what's the link for this? Where'd you get this, dude? I don't know where he got it. Some Iranian newspaper, I guess. I guess I could Google it. Tehran, August 27th. Foreign Ministry spokesman Mohammad Ali Husseini said a large amount of weapons are being smuggled into Iran from Iraq. Talking to reporters on Monday, Husseini pointed out that terrorists and smugglers take advantage of the presence of foreign troops in Iraq and carry on with their sabotage activities in the Arab country. A large number of Iranian officers were martyred in their fight with smugglers and terrorists on the Iran-Iraq border, he said. He pointed out that the terrorists have become very active in northern Iraq in recent months. Iran and Iraq should do their best to prevent the presence of terrorists in the border areas. Oh, see, now this is about the attacks on the Kurds and stuff. I need to get Vineyard Saker on this show sometime. Or maybe just on the telephone here to talk about Kurdistan. I bet he knows. Not today, though, because I got an interview coming up in 10 minutes. But soon, you and I need to talk Kurdistan. I gotta make sure you guys read this. If you didn't hear the show yesterday, you might not have noticed. It's on the page in the top headlines today at antiwar.com. This is Larissa Alexandrovna and Muriel Kane in Raw Story. Study U.S. preparing massive military attack against Iran. And after the show yesterday, I went back and forth with Larissa a couple times in the email. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to do the show this morning. Prior commitments and so forth. But, she confirmed me, oh yeah, that's what it says, all right, 10,000 targets. And she asked them about it, and apparently, yeah, that's the deal. I don't know. I'm like speechless. I got 10 different things to say, and none of them really go anywhere. I don't know what the hell. 10,000 targets in the space of what amount of time? A week or two? How many aircraft carriers do you need for that? How many strategic bombers are already in place set up for that? According to this study, cited by Larissa Alexandrovna, they're already in place. The bombers are already in place. I just read an article the other day. The Stennis is coming home. They're going to do this with one carrier strike group there? You might remember 6 months ago, we were all frightened. They had three carriers in the Gulf. And Cheney was on one of them talking mad shit. With the brand new Lockheed F-22, or was that the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter in the background? Boy, you paid a pretty penny for that. Just think about this. Your entire lifetime of paying taxes, you went to pay for one little plate of composite sheet metal on that plane. All that hard work, every week you look at your paycheck and you go, you sons of bitches, I can't believe how much they take out of my check. God. You bought one piece of composite sheet metal for the, you know, wing flap on that plane. I hope you feel like you got your money's worth for Cheney to have his prop at his little warmongering speech there. But anyway, I'm off on the tangent. The point is, 10,000 targets? Really? That can't be right. Tell me that ain't right. I gotta get Larissa. What I need to do is I need to talk with this Dr. Dan Plesch and his buddy Martin Butcher. See if I can get their contact info from Larissa and see if I can get these guys on the show to explain this to me. I will note, they're not predicting the use of nuclear weapons. That's probably the most important thing. Of course, it's been reported since this time, 2005, that the nuclear option was quote-unquote on the table for dealing with Iran. And I guess they're saying in here, they don't think they'll use nukes because, oh man, you're not going to use nukes, are you? God damn, no. But then they say, but you know, if they really are intent on taking out the Natanz facility, it's a really hardened facility, and it might take nukes to do it. And once they start bombing it, if it's still intact, what do you think they're going to do? Stop? Yeah. Oh, and Vineyard Saker just sent me an email to scott@antiwar.com where you guys could reach me to updating the link for that news story. It was the irandaily.com. And, of course, that's the Iranians fighting the Kurds in northern Iraq. Something got to go over here. Yeah, geez, I don't know. So the American government is going around playing world policeman. And guess what? People don't like that. Rather than thinking, oh, hi, there's the sheriff. These are the people in my neighborhood. Hi, Mr. Sheriff. Instead, they think of the United States much more like a paramilitary SWAT team throwing hand grenades in their windows and kicking in their doors and pointing German submachine guns in their faces. I think it's much more like that on the receiving end of America's world policeman role. And why should we be surprised? That's how police are here in America. And this is, relatively speaking, one of the freest places in the world to live. And yet that's all cops are around here, is a bunch of jackbooted thugs with German machine guns and black masks and hand grenades and body armor. And, you know, most of us, at least those of us who actually have the capability in our cerebral cortex to use reason, consider them to be an oppressive, dangerous, occupying force wherever we live. So why should it be any different for the rest of the people on the receiving end of this foreign policy that, you know, takes the ATF and puts them out on a global scale. Why should we be surprised that they're not throwing flowers and candy at us? It's a police state here in Austin, Texas, and Austin, Texas is paradise. I'm telling you, if you've never been to Austin, Texas, let me tell you about Austin, Texas. It's beautiful. It's peaceful. The people around here know how to read. They're interested in things besides their own belly button and beer, at least some of the time. And people drive like shit, but you can always find good weed for reasonable prices. There's beautiful lakes and hills and trees. It's nothing like Dallas or Houston. If you've ever been to Dallas or Houston and you think you hate Texas, you just don't know. Austin is paradise. And yet Austin is a jackbooted police state. And this is about as good as it gets in this country. Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. We'll be right back here after this.
This only got one good ear left, boy. You want to save it? You want to talk?
All brother died of an overdose.
Yes, Lord.
An overdose of black misery.
Listen. When they arrest a black man, they need 30 cops or more. Well now, when they arrest a black man, they need 30 cops or more. Well now, hey, if you a black herb smuggler, they will watch you by the hour.
Listen.
It only means that if you have more money, then you have more power.
Listen.
They will come in the night.
Listen.
And they will read you your rights.
Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and my guest today is my friend, Nelson Linder. He's the director of the local Austin, Texas office of the NAACP. Welcome to the show, Nelson.
Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
Hey, man, I'm doing great, and it's fantastic to be here and be on your show.
I know. I've been looking forward to interviewing you for so long, and unfortunately, I'm stuck covering foreign policy pretty much all day, every day on this show. But, you know, I'm also getting sick and tired. Well, I have been for a long, long time, sick and tired of seeing the Austin Police Department murder unarmed men, almost in every case, I think, unarmed black men in this town. And something's got to be done about it, if only publicly shaming them. If that's all I can do, then we'll do that. You know what, if it's okay with you, I'd like to go ahead and just real quick, you know, just for a minute or two, if we can just get this out of the way.
Sure.
I wanted to see if I can get, you know, a quote of you on tape. I already know what you're going to say, about Ron Paul. Here's a man who they have nothing on him. His middle name is Ernest. He's been married to his wife for 50 years, you know, was a milk boy when he was a little kid and a, you know, track star, and they just got nothing on him. They got nothing, except in the 1980s, some papers were written by a ghost writer, as I know that you know, that said some pretty disparaging things about black folks, and it is still going around on the blogosphere. People will not just use their Google and do their research. They just take the first link they find, and these rumors are still going around that Dr. Ron Paul is some kind of racist. And I know that you know Dr. Paul, so I was just wondering if I could, you know, give you a chance to describe what you believe his character is.
Well, sure. I met Ron Paul about 20 years ago on another station, and he was doing a presentation, and I called in and talked to him. I've also read his work. Let's face it, Ron Paul is a thinker. He's also a constitutionalist. He believes in the Constitution. And in America in 2007, where that document has been tossed around like a piece of paper, he's a very, very dangerous man. He's talking about real issues. He's very intelligent. He's very informed. And he's a free thinker. So that's going to invite attacks on him. As far as a comment, there are a lot of folks who don't quite understand the libertarian philosophy. I mean, we appreciate the fact that you watch the Constitution, but in reality, as black people sometimes, we don't feel social policy. And sometimes people can say things in a context where it can be distorted and have a much greater impact. So I think in his case, he was basically taken out of context. I've watched his work. I admire what he does on foreign policy. And I think what he's doing, he has a lot of potential. I just think that in the future, we want to talk more about social issues, because in reality, if you're talking about trying to have a meaningful impact on the American political system, you've got to understand that as African Americans, we do have to deal with social issues because of our history. And I think if they would do that as well as talk about the fact that the Constitution is very, very important, I think a lot of folks would be a lot more comfortable not only joining the dialogue, but perhaps even being a part of the party. So I like Ron Paul personally. I like what he's saying. I think he's sincere. I think he's correct in what he's saying. And I hope that more folks in the other parties, the other two parties, develop the courage to join him and address the issues that I think will decide the fate of this country in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very important point, and I think it's a fair criticism of Dr. Paul that he perhaps does not spend enough time explaining carefully to some of the weakest among us and the poorest among us who look to the government to be their safety net and so forth. He's got to really address them particularly and explain why it is that the absolute liberty or close to absolute liberty he endorses is really the way that they ought to go, the policy they ought to support.
Exactly.
And I think that's a fair criticism that he could do better about that. And I'll do my best to, through a couple of degrees of separation, hopefully I can pass on that message to him from you. I take that very seriously. But and you've met him, right? You've sat down and had dinner with Ron. But you never thought that he was thinking, oh, a black guy under, you know, while your back was turned or anything?
No. I met him. We had a very, very direct handshake. We looked out of eye. He's a very informed man. No, not at all. That was not my impression at all. He was very, very careful about what he said. He was not disrespectful. I don't get that from Ron Paul. I think he's a very serious person. I just think he was taken out of context based on that conversation. I never got that impression from him at all.
Yeah. Well, and I totally agree with that. And like you said, the man's a libertarian, and the libertarian philosophy is, of course, everyone is an individual to be judged by the content of their character, period. So how could he possibly be a racist if he's an individualist?
Right, right. And I think, too, Scott, if we look at the big picture here, we're talking about the Constitution. I mean, my God. You can't have a more important topic than that particular document in 2007, because if we understood it, we wouldn't allow what's happening in this country currently today to go on. So I think he's got the right topic, obviously. We need to figure out some way to involve the American public in general and show them that even in 2007, if you understand that document, you can use it to change things. But unfortunately, let's face it, it requires discipline, it requires a certain kind of courage and a certain kind of scrutiny, and nobody wants to be attacked for having a different point of view. So I think that's a challenge he faces in this time when we're looking at almost a certain kind of fascism in this country.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. And you know, I went to his barbecue birthday party in Houston over the weekend, and part of his speech, he talked about how people sometimes criticize him for wanting to be a weak president. He wants to basically give up all the unconstitutional powers that the presidency has usurped from the people, the states, and the Congress,
right,
and return it where it belongs under the real separation of powers and so forth. And people criticize him for that. And he pointed out, and I absolutely agree, that it takes strength. It takes incredible moral strength to resist the temptation of power. And Ron Paul is that perfect balance where he's just barely willing to run when people beg him to. But then he only wants the power so he can give it up. And that takes an incredible amount of strength to resist, you know, the ability to use the power of the state against whoever you might want for whatever your whim. That's the way basically all the rest of them act. And so, you know, I believe that he's really the strongest willed of them all, and it's because of his moral center.
Well, I think another thing, too, is that if we look at America today, Scott, 77% of the American population can name the Three Stooges. Less than 30% can tell you about the separation of powers, about executive power,
right,
about legislative power, judicial power. So we have a problem. Until we educate the population about what the Constitution really is and about the importance of checks and balances, mm-hmm, he won't be fully appreciated. And that's my challenge as well. How do we get folks to think about things that are important in this country, like the Constitution, like separation of power? And I think that's our challenge. More work, more information. We have to also engage people in different places. We can't have these conversations on the fringes. We've got to go to town hall meetings. We got to go to where these other folks are. We got to encourage folks to look at these different parties. The two-party system has failed America. I have no doubt about that. It has failed America. We're an evolving country now. We're drawing with all kinds of diversity. Let's look at options and different ideas. If we don't do that, we're going to basically do a tremendous disservice to ourselves. So I think the idea of an independent thinker, a new party that's based on the Constitution, we really couldn't come at a better time. We need that challenge, and I hope folks will have enough courage to research the party and look at what they're really trying to do, I think, from a total standpoint, especially in foreign policy, because let's face it, when you're invading foreign countries and killing hundreds of thousands of people, I mean, how immoral can you get? It doesn't get any dirtier than that.
No, it doesn't. It is the worst possible situation. And even just this week, what the situation on the ground in Iraq is just incredible. It's unbelievable.
And these are young folks, Scott, like you and I, who have been sacrificed for absolutely nothing, for money and power. I mean, that in itself is enough reason to look at Ron Paul seriously. But also, look at the whole party and try to find ways, once again, to make it more, I think, relevant to everybody. I know you're not going to put everybody, but make it more relevant socially and try to educate folks about what you're really trying to accomplish. And I'm definitely committed to that, because we need change in this country. And until we invite change, these other parties are not going to really address us at all. And
right.
I'm very serious about that.
Yeah, you are. And your history here in Austin, Texas is, you know, going an extra 10 miles on every case requiring it, which is an endless list, to just simply try to hold the government to their own laws. I mean, I can't think of a single radio interview or TV interview or anything I've ever seen of you where what you're saying is, you know, we need some kind of, you know, massive this or that. All you're saying is, listen, it's not okay for you guys to go around killing unarmed black guys and the law not applying to you the same way it applies to us. I mean, think of the double standard. Let's get this really straight, everyone in the radio audience out there. If Nelson Linder killed a cop even in self-defense, they kicked in the wrong door, he thought it was a robber, and he shot defending himself, you know, they would give him the needle.
No doubt
Texas.
About that.
Black man kills a cop, he gets the needle in the arm, period.
That's
if a
right.
cop kills Nelson Linder, that cop is going on paid vacation, and the grand jury's going to turn around a no-bill, and that's the end of story.
Unfortunately, that's our history. The good thing is, now we're talking about the 14th Amendment in every conversation. And I think we have a new police chief who I think kind of understands that. I see a cultural change here because folks are educated. We're talking about the Constitution every day, the Fourth Amendment. When you make that the conversation and you show the disparities, it's going to expose a lot of people. So I think right now with Acevedo and some of his key people in key positions, and because of the public issues that we've raised now, I think folks are thinking about this use of force in Austin, how really unjust it really is. It's been a long fight. But I think now some of them are finally listening to what we're saying, and we have to stop this. And, for example, the DA's office. Now, let's face it. I mean, you have a DA here who does not respect the 14th Amendment. Otherwise, why the disparities?
Right.
So, once again, it's the Constitution, it's the education, and it's also calling a spade a spade. We have to do that to make sure people understand what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And even, you know, 14th Amendment aside, I mean, I guess if I take your meaning, what you're saying is the 14th Amendment applying the National Bill of Rights to the states and that it must be respected in that sense. But, hell, the law in Texas is that it's not okay to murder people, and if you do, you go on trial for it. Shouldn't matter if you're a cop or not.
That's right. And we also talk about, Scott, equal protection of the law. Everybody
right.
should be protected equally.
Right.
Not just white people, okay?
Uh-huh.
And also due process. We all need due process, not just this police office.
You know what? Here's something I wonder about, and I wonder what your perspective is. It doesn't seem to me, from, you know, a much more of an outside perspective than you have on this, certainly. But it doesn't seem to me that the cops who, and to be clear, we're talking about, what, a dozen or two dozen unarmed black guys been killed by this government just in this most recent millennium started a few years back.
Right.
It doesn't seem like the cops are, you know, illiterate, redneck, mullet-headed, racist types. And I wonder whether it's really just the impunity rather than actual racism. You know what I mean?
I
they want to kill somebody, and they know they can get away with killing a black guy.
I think you're right. I think, number one, definitely the impunity, but also I think it's subjective. And this society, let's face it, if you're black, you mean less in terms of life. And let's face it also, Scott, when you shoot black folks in this country and you wear a uniform, you get away with it. So I think it's the culture. It's the fact that we tolerate it. It's the fact that they can do it. And let's face it, the cops are trained to enforce the law. So if you can do these kind of things to a certain population that the government has disrespected historically, then who's going to really change that? So that's part of our culture and part of orientation. So until we have cops themselves that say, wait a minute, this is not right. And right now it's happening within the department. When cops themselves say, look, we need to make sure that we're fair with everybody, this stuff will stop. I've studied it all over the country. When police officers enforce their own ranks and say, look, we're human beings, so are they. This kind of behavior begins to subside, and that's kind of what we need to be today.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to come from within the department, but also the society at large.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a matter of community support. And I
Absolutely.
Guess that's really what's going on here is I am officially, I mean, it's been a long time, but, you know, I am publicly and officially completely and totally withdrawing my support from these people. They don't deserve it.
Exactly.
And it's not okay to kill people, even if they're black. Wow.
That's right.
How's that for a revolutionary statement, huh?
That's right.
Killing people is wrong, even if you're wearing a blue uniform.
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, here's the thing, too. You know, we mentioned checks and balances and so forth, the separation of powers. In the Anglo-American tradition going back 800 years, we have this thing called the grand jury, which is it's created for a couple of reasons. The first reason is so that the prosecutors don't just get to pick who they want to put on trial,
right.
And neither do the police. They have to check it with the neighborhood first, and if the neighborhood agrees that there should be a trial, then there's a trial. And that's to protect us from them. And the other purpose of it, of course, is that if the prosecutors don't want to prosecute a case because, say, for example, an APD shot an unarmed black guy in the back, the grand jury still has the power to go ahead and indict anyway and hold a trial even if the prosecutor didn't want to in the first place. And instead, what is the grand jury? It's a rubber stamp for Ronnie Earl, accessory to murder, and it works exactly the opposite of how it's supposed to work. It's there to rubber stamp every persecution of us and to rubber stamp every protection of them.
That's true, Scott. In fact, but in 2003, when they shot and killed Jesse Owens, The grand jury was actually very, very active. They did research. They made public statements. They told the city of Austin that there's an unbalance here in terms of race. You need to address this. They actually challenged Ronnie Earl and said, this is wrong. Now, in that particular case, we got an indictment. But guess what? Ronnie Earl took it to a judge, and they threw it out based on technicality. So when a grand jury uses its own power, it can actually investigate. It can be proactive. When they understand what their role really is, they can actually challenge the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. But once again, if people are not informed about their rights, they can't be effective. So I think even in the grand jury process, it's not a passive body. If they would challenge the prosecutor to, for example, let them know what the options are, not just one option. Give me an A, give me a B, give me a C, but also let me form my own opinion. You can actually challenge the DA and be more active, but unfortunately, in most cases, we don't get that. We get very passive grand juries. We also have to change that as well.
Yeah. That, wasn't that like the first indictment of a cop in Austin in 100 years or something?
Well, when it comes to black folks, certainly.
Yeah.
And once again, you know, we got the indictment, but Earl said it was not technically found, and he needs a judge. He knew a Judge Brenda Kennedy, who unfortunately was an African-American, and they threw it out.
Well, so wait a minute. What was the technicality? What was wrong with the indictment, and was it Ronnie Earl's fault that it was had a technicality wrong with it in the first place?
Yeah, but of course he blamed the grand jury, saying it was poorly construed and improperly written. That was his actual statement.
Well, but isn't it his responsibility to make sure that, well, I guess it's not, right?
Well, according to him, it's not. And unfortunately, nobody in the legal profession, Scott, nobody challenged this guy. Now, this is a huge
case.
Nobody challenged this guy. He got away with that.
You know, pretend that this is funny. I already told you this joke last time I saw you, but I was interviewing Max Blumenthal, who went to the Christians United for War in the Middle East, Israel conference thing, and he interviewed Tom DeLay. Got a good couple of sound bites of Tom DeLay. When I interviewed Max Blumenthal, he said this didn't make it into the video, but one of the things that Tom DeLay told him was that when it came to all the prosecutions and in his indictments, that was the devil behind that. And I said, well, you know, if he's referring to Ronnie Earl, he may very well be right about that.
You know, and also, I think the devil works through human beings, unfortunately. So if you got evil people doing evil things, that's how he operates.
Yeah.
We also have to understand that, and we have to deal with that.
And you know what? I'm foreign policy all day long, and I know you pay much more attention to these kinds of local issues. Does Ronnie Earl have any redeeming qualities whatsoever? Because all I can think of is his absolutely, totally, and completely botched prosecutions of the yogurt shop murderers. I can remember him indicting and trying Lucretia Murray, was it 3 or 4 times for a crime that everybody knew she didn't admit.
Yep.
Commit a little 11-year-old girl at the time that he framed her up. I don't know how legit they are, prosecutions of Tom DeLay to try to get on TV. Does this guy have any redeeming qualities except for perhaps persecuting DeLay?
Ironically, around Texas, if you ask the attorneys, they say he's a pretty good DA. Now, whatever that means, I don't know, but that's what they say, that he's fairly progressive. That's the irony. Compared to most DAs in the state of Texas, this county has a fairly progressive reputation.
Yeah,
but
well,
when it comes
I'm
to certain issues, that's the general public. That's not my interpretation, but that's what they say.
Yeah.
But when it comes to key issues, this guy simply does not get involved. If you deal with police brutality on African Americans, in my opinion, he doesn't really get involved. That's just the other way around. But according to the state, overall, he's a fairly progressive DA.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, see, I'm not sure progressive really counts for much. I mean, in a cultural sense, if that means that, you know, you don't wear a white hood, then okay, congratulations or whatever. But to me, progressive just means progressively more and more state until we're all slaves.
Yeah, what it means is basically that he's a Democrat in a state that's primarily mostly Republican, and that's not good enough. We should accept that, actually.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, you know. And really, that is how it is. It's part of this two-party system, right? It's like, well, at least he's not a Republican.
That's right.
Jeez, I don't know if I'd prefer the Republican that ran against him last time. I forget the guy's name, but I remember thinking, oh, my God, this guy might be even worse.
Well, that's the irony. But I think this time around, we're going to see a more progressive situation. I'm getting that impression right now. It's going to be a much better, I think, choice, in my opinion. But we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. Well, and you did mention, you actually have some hope for this new police chief, huh?
Yeah, I think he has a great background. I think he's a real person. He's on the street. He's talking to folks. But more importantly, I think he's hiring the right cops and putting them in the right positions. I think that is critical. He's aware of the early warning system. He understands the importance of discipline, of enforcement. And he talks to folks as human beings. So I think he's got a great potential here if we support him and also realize that once he makes the right decisions, and we have to see how the society reacts to him, because let's face it, in this town, for the most part, historically, the union has run things politically. So if he begins to fire police officers, how will we support him and protect him from the union and these other folks here who have had it their way for a long way? That's my concern, but I think he's going to be okay because he's a straight-up guy.
Oh, and that's a great point, too. The police unions, the government employee unions.
Right.
Boy, there's a force you don't want to mess with, man.
Yeah. See, these factors like the union, civil service law, the fact that the state, for example, is very quiet on this issue. Why are our state reps on these issues? Why are they challenging injustice in Travis County? Why are they challenging these things all over the state of Texas? They're not. So this is a huge political issue. And while we fight it locally, it's really a national issue.
Yeah. Well, although, you know, in my view, I don't know how you feel about this exactly, but in my view, it's a national issue to be solved locally.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly.
I mean,
certainly.
And in fact, you know, you mentioned the 14th Amendment and so forth, and I wanted to ask you whether you think, and this will be a controversial kind of thing, I guess.
Okay.
But I look at asking the national government to come in and do their civil rights investigation as the worst distraction and waste of time. You know, honestly, and I know it hasn't been, you know, to the benefit of black folks that the Bill of Rights was construed this way originally, but the Bill of Rights on the national level, in the national constitution, is supposed to be a list of restrictions against their power. It's
right.
not a mandate to the Justice Department
right.
to come in and, you know, file lawsuits against states or whatever. And it just seemed to me that if we would never, you know, focus our energy on trying to get the Justice Department to come in and do a civil rights violation investigation, which never leads to anything anyway, why
right.
should it, then that energy could be better spent here smearing and destroying the reputation and career of Ronnie Earl, accessory to murder.
Well, let's put it in context. Historically speaking, when they came to town from the national government, they would come in and stop lynchings and stop people
right.
like Bull Connor. So
I understand.
In that case,
yeah.
Mississippi was burning, Georgia was burning, Alabama was burning, and Texas was burning. So in that case, the national government provided a certain kind of relief. But in 2007, where you have more rights, I'm with you. It helps to have some sort of oversight, but I'm not sure that is real oversight. So I think we do it as an option. We do it as a strategy. Because in reality, what alternatives do we have? We can't get these things solved locally because in reality, where do you go? If the DA says no, then what's the next step?
Yeah.
So I think there's a hope that sometime, somehow, from a national standpoint, there might be a more fair perspective based on public scrutiny where at least these states might be exposed. But that's a straw. I understand that. But it's an option based on a political history
right.
that we can't deny.
Right, yeah, that's clearly understandable. And hey, the people of Austin have proven that they don't care,
right.
Nelson. They don't care right. when these guys come and shoot your neighbor in the back.
Right, and keep in mind also, that's a request. If these things were done properly locally, we'd never call the federal government.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And yeah, you know, I don't know. I just, here we are, 2007, I don't think you could find more than, you know, what, 3 or 4 or 5%. If that many of the population of this town and the surrounding suburbs, etc., who would openly tell you, yeah, I'm a racist, what of it? It's not cool to be a racist. Nobody's a racist. It's stupid to be a racist. And yet, what do we have? We got a big federal highway divides our town in half, with you on one side and me on the other. Not very far on the other side, by the way.
Scott, I always tell folks, in the scientific world, there are protons, there are neutrons, there are electrons. In the real world, if folks who are neutral, that's what a problem. If they weren't neutral, they could have an impact. If all the folks who were neutral on this issue got involved, we could change the system tomorrow.
Right.
So don't be neutral. Get involved and take a position. And that's our problem, Scott. We have too many folks here who will see a lynching and look the other way. If they will stop the lynching, this stuff will stop. So I want to challenge folks who are neutral. Get involved and take a position and make a difference. It doesn't have to be right, but say something and do something.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I saw this statistic the other day in a different context. I wonder if you could verify this for me. Is it true that Texas has the largest prison population of all the states?
That's what we've heard. I will certainly, I feel very secure in saying that, absolutely.
Yeah, and of course, California has, what, twice the population of Texas, something like that?
Absolutely, that's right.
And you know, I don't know, I'm not really asking you to verify this or not. This one I heard years and years ago, but it was something about Texas executes as many people as Texas is first, and then the United States is second, and then China's third in execution, something like that.
And it's also been verified. Absolutely. This system in Texas right now under Rick Perry is absolutely gruesome. And the other thing is, once again, who's really going to challenge it? We had a joke in the last election, and they made it a joke, really. And this state is very, very serious in terms of what it does. It's regressive. it's really deplorable, but once again, we accept it and we tolerate it.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, as long as we're both speaking perfectly reasonably and sounding like some kind of radicals because of how radical our actual situation is, let me go ahead and sound like a radical. How about this one for you, Nelson Linder, local director of the NAACP? How about we just abolish the APD and the Travis County Sheriff's Department, and if people want security, they can just hire their own damn security, and then we can all be free. How about that?
Well, Scott, hey, man, now wait. Now, we do need some kind of law and order, and I'm afraid that if we did that, the inmates might be running the asylum, so...
Well, but I mean, that's what we got now, is the inmates running the asylum. Here's what I mean.
I know what you mean. I agree.
We need law. We need law.
Right.
I just don't think we need a monopoly on it, and I don't think that we need a security service that none of us are allowed to fire. Why should we... I mean, look, everything that government does, business does better. Why should security be an exception?
I think my point would be that even in these organizations like APD and the Sheriff's Department, they're good, decent people.
Agreed.
And I think if they do their jobs and remain human beings, that's how we solve problems. I don't have a problem with the institution themselves. I think we need good people there who don't become a part of the institutions and they remain human beings. So I have a different point there. I think we can do the right thing if we have the right people there who are committed to human rights and treat us as human beings. But unfortunately, sometimes these institutions have a life and a power of their own. And that's where the problem, I think, comes from.
Yeah, well, and it's the lack of accountability, and don't worry, I'm not going to try to get you to, go on the record as an anarcho-capitalist today or anything here on the radio. But the thing is, it's the lack of accountability. For example, if I drive down 6th Street or I walk down the sidewalk on 6th Street on a weekend evening, there are on this corner and this corner and that corner, there are cops standing around, eating steroids and looking like tough guys and being the biggest gang on the block and basically treating people like absolute garbage. And my theory is that if the bar owners downtown hired Stanley Smith and Burns Security and so forth, and it was their dollar that was being put into the security officer's pocket, then they would insist that they provide good security and treat all their customers with respect, or else they would be fired. And yet the APD is never fired. The APD's contract has never expired. It's always here, and it's always going to be here. They get all their money right out of our paychecks, right out of the price of everything we buy at the store, they don't have that private capitalist incentive to provide a good service for a reasonable price.
I think that's a very, very serious argument. I'll agree with you there. When you take out the incentive factor, obviously we suffer. I think that capitalism does have some virtues. Anytime you deal with a private enterprise where it's based on incentives and the end result, obviously that has a big impact in a positive way. But sometimes if you deal with institutions, let's face it, we're not a purely capitalist society anyway.
I mean,
we have a mixed market here that has some of everything, really, to be honest about it. But so we're not really there yet.
Mm-hmm.
I just think if we have folks who can understand that concept, we'll be okay. But in reality, they don't because of education, which is really indoctrination.
Yeah. Well, what about Nelson Linder for district attorney?
Hey,
I'm serious.
You know what, man? Hey, man, I'm more interested in education and private enterprise. My goal is, I'm a business guy. I think if you can treat organizations, institutions that can make money and hire people and do it the right way, we can change the society. Because in reality, when I do that, I can support folks who I think have good ideas so we can put a balance back into the systems. My goal is to change the society from within by having, number one, great educational system, opportunities, and encouraging folks to be the best they can possibly be. And that's all happening in America in 2007.
Yeah, and you know what? That's why I've always been so fond of you. Long before we ever did any business together, I heard you over and over on KLBJ radio and saw you interviewed on the local news channels and so forth. And it's so obvious that you got your principles in the right place, that you only mean the best for people, obviously extremely active in the community in all facets besides just defending people from police brutality and so forth. And I guess I don't really know, Nelson, but if I had to guess, I bet that you've done a hell of a lot to wake people up to that way of thinking and get them thinking along those very same lines.
And close, Scott, and also that they can make a difference. If you get involved, make a difference. And don't be afraid to look at people like Ron Paul and others who are saying something different. Be courageous enough to be different. Read what these guys are saying. Look at America overseas, what they're really doing. Read the Constitution, see where we are today in 2007. If we can encourage folks to be creative and take chances, and every risk that we take, Scott, can be managed. Take a risk, do something different, and change the system for the better.
All right. Nelson Linder, everybody, from the local NAACP. Thanks, Nelson.
Thanks, man. You take care.
face of NWA versus the police department, prosecuting attorneys are MC Ren, Ice Cube, and Easy motherfucking E.
Order, order, order. Ice Cube, take the motherfucking stand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help your black ass?
You goddamn right.
Well, won't you tell everybody what the fuck you gotta say?
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe to toe in the middle of a sale. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the product. Thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You'd rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a Benzo. Be the police out of shape, and when I finish, bring the yellow tape. To tape off the scene of the slaughter, still getting swole up bread and water. I don't know if they fags or what. Search a nigga down and grabbing his nuts. And on the other hand, without a gun, they can't get none. But don't let it be a black and a white one, cause they'll slam you down to the street top. Black police showing out for the white cop. Will swarm on any motherfucker in a blue uniform. Just cause I'm from the CPT, punk police are afraid of me, huh? A young nigga on the warpath, and when I finish, it's gonna be a bloodbath of cops dying in LA. Yo, Dre, I got something to say.
Testimony to the jury about this fucked up incident.
Fuck the police, and Ren said it with authority. Because the niggas on the street is a majority of gang. It's with whoever I'm stepping. And a motherfucking weapon is kept in a stash spot for the so-called law. Wishing Ren was a nigga that they never saw. Lights start flashing behind me. But they're scared of a nigga, so they mace me to blind me. But that shit don't work, I just laugh. Because it gives them a hint not to step in my path. But police, I'm saying, fuck you, punk. Rights and shit, it's all junk. Pulling out a silly club so you stand with a fake ass badge and a gun in your hand. But take off the gun so you can see what's up, and we'll go at it, punk, and I'ma fuck you up. Make you think I'ma kick your ass, but drop your gat and Red's gonna blast. I'm sneaky as fuck when it comes to crime, but I'ma smoke them now and not next time. Smoke any motherfucker that sweats me, any asshole that threatens me. I'm a sniper with a hell of a scope, taking out a cop or two. They can't cope with me. The motherfucking villain that's mad, with potential to get bad as fuck. So I'ma turn it around, put in my clip, yo, and this is the sound. Yeah, something like that, but it all depends on the size of the gap. Taking out a police would make my day, but a nigga like Ren don't give a fuck to say.
Fuck the police.
I'm tired of the motherfucking jacking, sweating my gang while I'm chilling in the shack and shining the light in my face. And for what? Maybe it's because I kick so much, but I kick ass. Or maybe because I blast on a stupid ass nigga when I'm playing with the trigger of an Uzi or an AK. Because the police always got something stupid to say. They put out my picture with silence, because my identity by itself causes violence or E with the criminal behavior. Yeah, I'm a gangster, but still I got flavor. Without a gun and a badge, what do you got? A sucker in a uniform waiting to get shot by me or another nigga. And with a gat, it don't matter if he's smaller or bigger. And as y'all know, E's here the rule. Whenever I'm rolling, keep looking in the mirror and is on cue, yo, so I can hear a dumb motherfucker with a gun. And if I'm rolling up the eight, he'll be the one that I take out and then get away. While I'm driving off laughing, this is what I'll say.
Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Fuck the police.
guilty of being a redneck, white bread, chicken shit motherfucker.
Folks, this is Anti-War Radio. That was NWA and MDC and the great Nelson Linder. And I'm sorry, I totally forgot to ask Nelson Linder about how you folks could join up or find out about local community goings on and so forth. I'd like to find out how I can help out and if I can do anything other than deny the slightest bit of legitimacy to that accessory to murder and serial kidnapper, Ronnie Earl, the district attorney. Vineyard Saker on the Stress Block comment section asks, what's this about prosecuting an 11-year-old girl five times? What? Yeah, Lucretia Murray. I wish I'd asked him more about her. I wonder how she's doing now. I think maybe I'll call him back after the show and see what I can find out. 11-year-old girl. Somebody killed a little girl that her mom was babysitting. Or maybe she was being babysat. And somebody killed the little girl at the house where she was. And there was, you know, 1,000 pieces of evidence said the stepdad did it. The mother's boyfriend did it. But the cops, these APD jackbooted thugs, grab this 11-year-old girl without her mother there, without any sort of legal counsel to intervene and protect her, and they put her in this tiny little room, an 11-year-old girl. Put her in a tiny little room under hot lights and said, admit it, you kicked her, you kicked her, you kicked her, you kicked her, you kicked her for like 6 hours. More than that. Could have been 12, I forget, it's been a few years. And look, this is the quote. Okay, fine. If you guys want me to say that I kicked her, if that's what'll let me get out of this room, then fine, I kicked her. I mean, that was the confession. And Ronnie Earl thought, you know what? I bet I could get on TV. And the 11-year-old girl in this circumstance is black, and so it's not like she was born with natural rights or anything. So I'll just go ahead and destroy her. And I'll get myself on TV, thought Ronnie Earl. And so he prosecuted her and convicted her. And the judge said no and threw it out. And he prosecuted her and convicted her. And then the judge said no and threw it out. And then I think the third one was a grand jury, and then the fourth one he convicted her again, and then the judge threw it out again. Because it was bull. Now, of course, to an Austin jury, they don't care. She's a black girl. She doesn't have natural rights. The burden of proof is on this 11-year-old girl to prove that she didn't do it. And the fact that there is one monopoly security agency in Austin with no competition means that they didn't have anybody else looking for anybody else who might have done it. This ain't Matlock, where the lawyer comes in and gets the mother's boyfriend on the stand and makes him crack and admit it. Not that Judge Lynch would have allowed that in the first place. And so Ronnie Earl prosecuted Lucretia Murray, I think it was four, it could have been five times, for a crime that she did not commit. A crime that she was, in essence, we're talking about an 11-year-old girl, in essence, it was beaten out of her, this phony confession. And, I wish I could remember all the evidence and stuff, because it was, compelling testimony by the medical examiners and everybody. It's just the worst farce, the worst abrogation of justice. Absolutely horrible. And did Ronnie Earl ever go to prison for his serial kidnapping of poor little Lucretia Murray? What would Ronnie Earl do to you if you kidnapped Lucretia Murray? But it's perfectly okay for him to kidnap her and hold her on bogus charges and try her over and over and over again on bogus charges like it's goddamn Guantanamo Bay. So that's the story of the little girl who was prosecuted over and over and over again maliciously by Ronnie Earl, the accessory to murder serial kidnapper, who himself belongs in a cage until he dies of natural causes. Life. They have that now. Life without parole in Texas. They finally did that. See, for so long, there was either life, but you might get out in 10, or the death penalty in order to try to force the jury's hands to find in favor of death. Because they don't want to let some horrible criminal who they might be tempted to spare his life get out in 10 years. Well, now they finally, the Texas State Legislature finally has created life without parole as a sentence in this state. So that's where Ronnie Earl belongs, rotting in a cage in Huntsville with the rest of the criminals. I'm sure they treat him really well. And that's it. That's anti-war radio, or as it should be called, my war against the state radio. And we'll be back here tomorrow.